and kind of established distribution across the country, and it's worked well. We do have that ability to tell people, well, you might have to drive a little farther, but I think this will...
You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1. Listen to Rootstock Radio every Monday at 5:30 on WEFT Community Radio. Coming up next is In the Know, a WEFT-produced public affairs show that highlights locally available resources. Stay with us for that and for other programming later, including Champaign-Urbana Radio Theater at 7, Monday Night R&R at 8, live local music on WEFT Sessions at 10, and recorded local music on Champaign Local 901 at 11. We have some underwriting to take care of, and then we will get to In the Know.
Today's broadcast is made possible with the support of Big Grove Tavern, located at 1 East Main Street in the heart of downtown Champaign. Big Grove Tavern is a classic tavern with a modern twist. You may enjoy their new all-day menu, available at 11 a.m. every day, with brunch on the weekends. Reservations can be made by calling 217-239-3505. You may visit biggrovetavern.com for menus and private dining options for groups of up to 100 guests.
Good evening, CU community. You're listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1. Welcome to In the Know, a public affairs show where social issues, trending topics, relevant research, and important perspectives are discussed so you, the listener, can be in the know. The opinions expressed on the show are those of the host and guests and not of WEFT. We're streaming live on my personal Facebook page, Sherry Williamson. Listeners are welcome to submit comments and questions on the Facebook live stream or via Twitter at Nature79. Tonight, we're going to be talking about child abuse. We're going to go beyond what you see in headlines, what you see in the movies. We're actually going to talk about what does child abuse really look like and how does it affect those who are part of that system. We have four guests with us tonight. I'm going to let them go around and introduce themselves. We'll start over here with Stacy.
Thank you so much for having me tonight, Sherry. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Stacy McNichol. I'm the owner and senior therapist at the Rock Counseling Group in Champaign. I started my career working at Carle Hospital in OB and NICU, transferred to multiple other health settings, Champaign County Mental Health Center, as well as serving as the lead therapist on the youth unit at the Pavilion Hospital, as well as doing crisis work for screening, assessment, and support services. So quite a bit of work with children.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Jessica McCann from Crisis Nursery. Thank you so much for having me. I've spent all of my career so far at Crisis Nursery. I started out as a lead children's specialist there. Eventually went to field work as a family specialist. And now I am coordinating our programs as program coordinator there. So thanks again.
Great. My name is Candy Murphy. I'm a retired school teacher, and I now volunteer for CASA as an advocate.
Hi, my name is Amy Hayes. I started my career with Lutheran Social Services here in Champaign. I went to the Pavilion for 6 years after that, and now I'm at Champaign County CASA.
Great, and thank you all for being here to discuss this important topic. So like always, we're just going to jump right in and have the discussion. So when we think about child abuse, I think we see what media shows us child abuse is. There's some truth to what they show, but I think that there is a little bit more glamorization when it comes to that. And child abuse is not as always cut and dry when you have, you know, for instance, the Child Protective Services go out and discuss, you know, what's happened. It's not always as simple as, okay, we can recognize child abuse. We know for sure that it's here. So in your line of, when your line of work, when you think about child abuse, what's your definition of child abuse?
Under the law, there are three subsections of abuse. There is the abused minor, the neglected minor, and the dependent minor. So an abused minor is a child under 18 years of age whose parent or any person that's responsible for their welfare inflicts or allows to be inflicted physical injury causing death, disfigurement, impairment, or physical or emotional health or loss, impairment of a bodily function, creates a substantial risk of the above, commits or allows to be committed a sex offense against the child, commits or allows torture, excessive corporal punishment, and sex crimes would be like servitude or prostitution. A neglected minor would be A child under 18 years of age that's not receiving proper care, such as food, clothing, shelter, medical care, environmental, anything that's environmental that's injurious to their health, or a newborn that's positive for substances. A dependent minor would be any minor under 18 years of age without a parent or guardian or custodian that could care for them. And that's not just financial. That could also be like mental health related or anything like that.
Okay.
Yeah, I think, you know, to add to that, this is a really serious issue. Nearly 7,000 children every year are abused annually. So that comes down to 1,670 children dying every year in the United States from abuse. This is a really serious issue. The complicating part is that the definition of what constitutes it tends to vary among professionals, as we're talking about here. So it can even vary among cultures. Even the World Health Organization has a different definition of it in a slight way. They defined child abuse and child maltreatment as all forms of physical and or emotional ill treatment, sexual abuse, neglect, or negligent treatment, or other commercial exploitation. So, I mean, we can look at the CDC's definition. Other countries also have their definition. So I think it encompasses or can encompass quite a few different things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we... You know, even when I was working as a child welfare worker, when you're speaking to the parents after the fact, after their children have been removed, there's argument there. What I did was not abuse. And they have justified it 1,000 different ways. And some of it's cultural. You know, this is just how we deal with these things in our household. Some of it, you know, may be a lack of knowledge that what they're doing can actually rise to the level of being considered abuse. So I think there's education that needs to happen on the part of parents so that we aren't seeing these children back in the system. I know that the court system, you know, case managers try very hard to make sure that that happens, but I think it can also be hard to break norms that are cyclical in cultures and in families when it comes to how you even discipline your children. So kind of going with that, why do you think we see such a fine line then when it comes to CPS coming out and somebody says, this is just how I discipline my children? How do you think that complicates it for instance, like a CPS worker?
That's a tough question, because that CPS worker is going to have to go by their guidelines. You know, in the state of Illinois, all guidelines that we have here, it's going to be different in every state. But here in our county, if we have a parent that is justifying something that we know as abuse, educating them is obviously the first step. But if it is severe enough, what they consider discipline may actually be abuse. Mm-hmm. And it may be time to let, you know, a judge decide, well, we may need to remove your child for a little while to let you get the help that you need to learn a better way to discipline. But that's why we have the system that is in place to kind of decide what does that need. But there's also an intact family case too that could be opened, which basically means, you know what, maybe we don't need to be court involved. Mm-hmm. Maybe you do need services. Maybe this family can be wrapped around with, you know, counselors or domestic violence, and we can keep the family intact with having eyes on you. You know, basically DCFS saying, we want to keep your family intact. We want to do that first. We don't want to pull you into the court. Let's get some services in there and see if things improve. And that's usually the first course of action. Mm-hmm. Usually that happens first.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of to add to that, referring back to abuse, we're sort of looking at it from the black and white perspective again of discipline. What we see a lot of the time is that there may be more gray areas like domestic violence that maybe doesn't appear to be violence to that family. It may be something cyclical from an upbringing that feels normal. Or that could be something along the lines of a socially acceptable drug use that might feel normal. And until CPS or some other presence is in the home, a lot of times that family may not know that that is abuse, like we were saying.
Mm-hmm. So we talk about the different influences when it comes to how we raise our children. You know, one of them is cultural, but we have talked about, for instance, domestic violence as well as mental health. How do you see mental health of a parent playing into child abuse?
Well, there are several different aspects of mental health, and it really depends on a parent's diagnosis, a parent's IQ, Maybe they're medicated. Maybe it can be, that's a very wide range. Maybe mm-hmm. they're medicated, but they're off their meds. So they're not regulated. And so they're not thinking clearly. Mm-hmm. Maybe they are a parent that has a low IQ and they cannot parent. Like they don't have the capacity to parent. That's also an issue with mental health.
So with mental health, we talked about that in actually a couple of our shows now, how mental health of a parent can undermine their parenting, either because it's undiagnosed, it's untreated, parents decide to go off their meds. You hear about it a little bit, for instance, when you're talking to parents within the school system, you know, they're trying to work with their students to help them, you know, with whatever academic issue or even behavioral issue that's going on. But when you have a parent who, you know, it's, you see it in the healthcare system when they're not investing in their own health, it's hard for them to see the importance of investing in their health with their children beyond basic standards of, okay, well, my child has to have their shots or my child has to go, you know, somewhere because they, you know, have a cold. But sometimes you see parents, even their primary care for their child is the emergency room, just like it is for themselves. And you see that a lot with mental health where parents have allowed a situation to escalate. And so now they're having to have, you know, something like I had one parent who admitted that they had had an ER visit because their depression had just gotten so severe that that was how they thought they should respond because they were feeling suicidal. They weren't even aware of other resources available like crisis line and things like that, but they knew that they felt unsafe themselves. And so what did that mean for their children? You know, parents who have a lot of stress going on, they always say that that's kind of what you see in the movies. Well, they're stressed out. You know, there's financial problems, so they lost their temper with their child. But I think it goes beyond just an isolated incident. I think we're talking about, you know, pathology of parenting where this is the response. This is not the exception. This is the rule. And so I think that's a distinction that also needs to be made. Parents, it's not the end of the world if you lose your temper with your child. However, again, if this is how you start to solve every single issue that's of its nature, now you're entering into abuse. So I think those are the types of distinctions that sometimes we need to make to parents where they see everything as an isolated incident. Well, this is because at this moment in this day, my child behaved this way. So this is how I responded, not realizing, well, that's the exact same thing you did yesterday and the day before or last week. This is becoming, you know, more of the nature of things. Do we see a correlation, though? I know other people tend to have the stereotype that it's a certain demographic only that has child abuse problems. Do we see a correlation with different demographics and child abuse?
To sort of what we like to do as part of our Beyond Blue program at Crisis Nursery, we serve mothers who are expecting a child or have a baby up to 1 year. And what we see specifically with postpartum in that is that depression doesn't have a face. Mental illness doesn't have a face. We serve participants from several different demographics, from several different ways of life. And I think one of the main components of what you're talking about with ending up in the emergency room or things like that is that sometimes there can be a stigma that maybe I'm not depressed enough to get help, or maybe I don't look like the person who I think should get help. And so if I'm not depressed enough to get help, then I may be hiding this or suppressing this. And then eventually that event may occur. I may end up in the emergency room. So sort of normalizing that and making the space that it's okay to talk about that day to day, and that it's okay to share those things and that you're not alone. And I think starting that discussion and sort of normalizing that is the way that that we'd like to go with that.
I think to add to that, you know, we kind of look at what the factors are, and you talked about kind of demographics. And I think there's no one single factor that can be identified as to why, you know, some adults might behave violently or neglectfully towards their children. So if we kind of think about multiple factors, the World Health Organization identified several factors that contribute both on a micro and a macro level. So if we kind of think about, you know, the individual level, their relationships, their you know, age, their sex, their personal history, economic equality, lack of social safety nets, cultural norms encouraging harsh physical punishment, those can all be kind of micro factors that we would look at as contributing towards things. If we look at on kind of a, you know, a larger level, how the society at large plays out, what their local community does, are there the right resources in place? All of those things can contribute to, you know, some of the factors of child abuse. So I think the demographics, just as you're saying, are kind of across the board. I mean, we could add substance abuse to that list. We could certainly add, you know, recent financial loss. Those would be other things as well.
Yeah, so there are obviously, you know, with a lot of different people who are in system, there's always multiple factors that can affect how they even get into the system, how they navigate that system, you know, families who don't have a lot of support. I think we also see, you know, kind of in the social work way, you see families doing more with less. You have multiple children, you have less, you know, as far as resources. And because of stigma, I think it can be hard. If you have a mother who doesn't recognize that she has postpartum depression, may not reach out to even friends or family, because what if that is me? What does that mean? How does that make me look as a parent? I think there is some perceived failure when you have mental health. You know, what's wrong with me? Why am I this way? And then again, if that's undermining your feeling of capability as a parent. So when we talk about child abuse in this process, so first there's something that's, you know, reported. If we can kind of fill in the gaps on what that process looks like, because again, I think people go by just what the movies say. This is the process. Somebody comes, you know, blaring and takes your child in the middle of the night, never returns them again. So maybe dispelling some of those misconceptions about, okay, so what's this process like? First, we have a hotline call, and then where do we go from there?
So the hotline determines whether or not it's going to get be information only, or whether or not it's going to get kicked to an investigator. And when an investigator gets the case, they have 24 hours to make contact with that family. They will call, go out, they do their own research on how to contact the family. If the intake person from the hotline call didn't get any information, but usually they do. So that's how it starts. They make contact with the family, they call, they go to the house. They present themselves, and then they start their investigation. They get information. They talk to the parents. They talk to the kids. They always start, usually, you know, not in front of the children by any means. And then a lot of times children are interviewed at the CAC, which is here in town, which is the Child Advocacy Center. And that is a place, a safe place for children to go and talk about what's going on in their home. And then from there, the investigator will make their recommendations, and they will either send it to an intact case if necessary. They will close it, and it could be unfounded if there is no evidence to support whatever the call was, or they could say, this is severe, we need to have a shelter care hearing. And that shelter care hearing is where they will write a shelter care report, which is their evidence of why the children need to be in care, and that temporary custody needs to be removed from the parent. In that hearing, the judge will hear evidence from the investigator, and the judge will decide if temporary custody needs to be removed from the parent at that hearing. And then they will set two additional hearings within like 30 days after that, called adjudicatory hearings. When children are placed in foster care, usually they are always asked if there's a family member that can take them first. They always want to place with family first. It's a very misconception that children are just going to go and live with strangers. That's not the case. They will always ask, do they have an aunt, you know, or a grandma? Is there anyone that in your family that can care for them? It's best to keep children connected to someone they know. They also have a new placement option now, which is called fictive kin, which is anybody that's connected to the child can be a placement for them. So someone in their church or in their school, you know, a neighbor down the street, anyone that could pass a background check and a home check, that could be someone that could keep them connected if temporary custody was to take place.
Okay. And so we realized, like you said, that it's best to keep a child in their environment instead of removing them. You know, to the point of they're living with somebody they don't know, living maybe with a demographic they're not familiar with, which can influence how they respond to foster care. So like you said, fictive kin is now an option, which is great to see that we are respecting, you know, even what a child determines to be a safe place for themselves. So I think a lot of people, again, have this misconception about the court system that, you know, you go to an adjudicatory hearing, then all of a sudden somebody says, oh, you're not as bad as we thought. Here's your children back. This is a lengthy process. I think that's why we have to be very proactive about how child abuse happens, because once children are in the system, they are kind of at the mercy of how this court system works, how their court case goes. And that is also being at the mercy of how their parent cooperates with their standards. Basic parenting standards, I know a lot of people have argued over the years, are very low. What parents have to do to get their children back is not rocket science. It's not, you know, getting water from the moon. It's, we need to know that you're going to be able to provide the very basic needs. You know, I was at a training one time and they said, somebody said, well, does a household have to have running water in it? And the person who was giving the seminar said, no, you don't have to have running water. So again, these are standards that really are, should be enough where a parent can get their child back. But again, we're talking about different demographics, different ways of approaching things. So in your experience, and maybe Candy, you can talk about cases you've had. How long have you seen children as part of their cases?
When you agree to become a CASA advocate, you agree to stay with a case for 2 years. That's typically how long a case will take to open and close. But I have to say, from an outside looking in, I did not have any experience with the criminal side of child abuse. And one of the things that I've been so impressed with working with CASA and working in the system is, one, the idea that family reunification really is the goal. And so the judges quite often will say to the parents, you know, this is not about playing gotcha. What we really want is for you to be honest. This is a time for you to get the help you need. This is the time for you to get the services you need. It's hard, and nobody's, you know, diminishing that. However, our goal is to get you back together, you know, and quite often they state clearly, you will be better off if you tell the truth. You will be better off if you work with us, like you said, you know, getting the help they need. And, you know, the judges and the caseworkers and everybody really is dedicated to reunifying that family. And beyond that, the way the hearings are set up, they really lend themselves to visitations, increased visitations, trying to keep a sense of normalcy. And so I was kind of one of those people that didn't quite understand, and maybe I was hesitant. Even as a teacher, you know, you were afraid to maybe make a call because you did not know what was would happen. You didn't know if it was in the best interest. And I have to say, after being an advocate, I am a believer in the system more so than not. And that's been really, really rewarding. I think the it's hard, but yet at the end, there's a lot of reunification. There's a lot of closed cases. There's a lot of families that are better off, and they were struggling because they didn't have the services. So now all of a sudden, their children are getting counseling. Now all of a sudden, the parents are getting counseling. You know, you look at domestic violence, and as part of my ongoing training, I've come to understand that I used to think that the scary thing was if a parent was abusing a child, but now I understand that it is much more damaging for a child to witness domestic violence, you know, and I was thinking older children processed it in a different way, and now I understand that younger children, you know, they have the effects in adulthood much more so than older children because of the brain development. Mm-hmm. And those are the type of, you know, facts that as a parent, you might not be aware of what you're doing. And so you get in the system and you get education and you get the services, and you really are better off on the tail end than struggling at the front end.
Yeah. Again, you know, kind of going back to this idea that parents just aren't aware of what they're doing. And even if they recognize what they've done, they may not have an appreciation for the long-term effects of how they're, you know, they're treating their children. A long time ago, when I actually started with CASA when I was in my early 20s, there was a saying that said, the way parents speak to their children becomes their inner voice as they get older. And that's what they keep defaulting back to, is what did my parents say? How did they, just even not, when blog I read from, and it now, adult who had been in the foster care system said, I just always remember how my mother talked to me. It wasn't always even what she said. It was that tone. I could see it on her face. What she was actually saying might contradict with what she was saying, because she was trying very hard to be supportive, but you could just see on her face that this was not what she wanted to be doing. And so that really stuck with this writer for a long time. And when the writer had children of their own, they had to consciously break that cycle because that was what was playing in their mind. And they were justifying it as, well, this is what happened with me and I've turned out okay. So maybe it wasn't so bad what my parent did, but they had to recognize that there are long-term effects. There's different research out there that says that, you know, how children are treated, it can have a change on them chemically and start to really have those long-term effects, especially because we know the brain doesn't stop forming until your mid-20s. And so how we may never even know the full effects of child abuse and how this type of thing, can be detrimental, not just within the family household, but as we've talked about before, society as a whole, when you have people who have been victims of abuse. So kind of going back to what you were saying with, there's a term called mandated reporter. Does somebody want to elaborate on what that is?
Well, as a school teacher, you know, we were mandated reporters and we were required every year at the beginning of the year to take a online class to learn about what abuse was and about the mandated reporting. And so teachers are, but, you know, doctors are. And I would say from a moral standpoint, we're all mandated reporters. Again, you know, if you're a neighbor and you hear something, you're not sure, you know, give it a call. And it's something, again, I've learned to appreciate from the outside looking in. Even if that call isn't taken, there does become a process. There does become a name. There does become something. And so I would say we're all mandated reporters.
Okay. Why do you think, though, people don't step in? Especially if you suspect that something's going on in a household, in your neighborhood, or even just somebody you know. It doesn't have to be something where the child comes to school with a black eye. You have a gut feeling. They'll have gut instinct. But why do you think people don't follow that?
I think fear is a big thing. Fear of they don't know the process. Will they know that I called? Will they know that I told? The DCFS hotline can be anonymous. You don't have to give your name if you don't want to. That's usually the biggest thing. If I just tell somebody else, you know, like a friend or another neighbor, maybe they'll call, you know. But I think fear is the biggest one. I don't think that people know that when you call the hotline, you don't have to give them your name. You don't have to tell them who you are. And they can still take the information and kick it to where it needs to go.
I think, too, a lot of people are just maybe not willing to get involved. You know, that's their family. That's how they do things. They're too busy. And, I mean, that sounds sort of sad, but we're all so busy on a daily basis. And we see a little snippet of something that we're not sure. You know, if we're out at a store and we see a parent maybe yelling at their child or disciplining a bit too harshly, we're in the middle of shopping. We may not even think about it.
Are you taking it out of context?
Yeah. So that's part of it as well. And so we kind of, you know, do that as well. I think the other part is there's this kind of fear, and it was explained here a little bit earlier, what's going to happen? Well, if I report this, this child's going to be whisked away from their family and taken away, and I'm going to be the cause of all of that. And so does this really warrant that? Is it to that level? And so I think it's really good that we're kind of talking about those misconceptions and what actually does occur when we call so that the facts can be sort of clarified.
Also coming sort of from a prevention perspective, a lot of times in our organization, and I know in many organizations, we build rapport and relationships with the participants that we see. And so though the best thing for the child is obviously to make that call, it can be difficult. A family that you formed a rapport with and that mom trusts you, because that can feel like a betrayal, even though it's the best thing for the child. Mm-hmm. And so what we see often is that, you know, that is our responsibility. And so that's what we'll do. And at Crisis Nursery, the things that we try to do the most is remain open with families. And so if we do notice something and we do find that a hotline call is necessary, more often than not, we always try to talk that through with the family. And our goal is to continue those services and continue those resources. And so I think that's where that fear comes from, is those resources possibly being cut off for that family. Mm-hmm. Obviously, in the end, we do what's best for the child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know he's somewhat controversial sometimes with how he looks at things. But Dr. Phil has always said that I would rather, you know, have 500 calls that ended up being false than missing the one call that was actually neglect or abuse. And then that child suffers because somebody didn't intervene on their behalf. But like you said, it can be scary. You know, even your involvement, once you make that call, What is your piece in that? Is it just the call and you're done? Some people are worried, am I going to be dragged through a court case with other people? I think that's where, you know, being able to dispel some of these misconceptions about what this process actually looks like. But, you know, a lot of times I think we also look at, again, these parenting standards. There's parenting standards, which is the very basic of the case itself. And then there's all the other resources that have to pile on top of it for the parent to get what they need. I've been reading some different articles that talk about how our opioid crisis is now becoming a huge factor in child abuse right now and foster care system, that we are seeing such a high increase of people who are abusing that unfortunately parenting is not their priority anymore. Their addiction is.
Well, I think, and I read that article you sent to me, which was fascinating. And I think part of that too, that I found really interesting, is that it can also end up with some neglect as well, from not having the resources to pay for food or to you know, have adequate housing. So I think we're seeing all facets of that within the abuse and neglect category. So it's interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, with when I was a child welfare worker, I saw that in a couple of my cases. And, you know, unfortunately, these are, I think some of it's cyclical. You have some type of addiction that runs in the family, whether it's alcohol, and then the next generation might be pushing it to something which some people perceive to be worse, although I see all addiction is the same. But, you know, now you're jumping from the mother who had maybe a prescription problem. Now she can't get her prescription anymore. So now we're going to heroin. And so I think society has shown that we are starting to set up the building blocks for abuse and for a lot of neglect, because like you said, there are issues when it comes to, you know, some parents just have the issue of, do I pay the rent or do I pay utilities or do I buy food for my family? Now you throw in another situation where, okay, well, there's all these other needs, but here's a want that I have, which they see as a need because of the pull of the addiction. And so now you have parents who are going with, I need to feed my addiction. I think we're also looking at how that becomes cyclical, like I said, where now the children are seeing their parents using. You either go one of two directions. You either accept that as the norm, and now you are able in your, you know, older years, maybe adolescence, to start using weed or start drinking. Well, this isn't a problem. I can control it. I'll do better than my parent did. Or you completely go in the opposite direction where I will never touch anything like that. But, you know, abuse, domestic violence, we also see that as cyclical within these families. So when we're looking at situations like substance abuse, what type of prevention do you see as being necessary from the aspect of child abuse to help, you know, keep this from happening, or for the ones who have it, you know, keeping this from becoming a repeating pattern? Which is the million-dollar question, of course.
You know, I think often, not to minimize addiction in any way, but I think we do see substance abuse as a coping strategy. You know, it's so much more than that at times, but many times we see, you know, I just can't deal with how depressed I'm feeling today, and I don't have any other tools to cope with it. And so I'm going to drink this alcohol and so that I don't have to feel any of these things. Coming from an end where we can provide and discuss coping strategies in a way that sort of prevents that, you know, I think that that's one end to start with. Not that it's that simple. Things are much more complex, but, you know, that's one end of the issue.
No, I think that's actually a really great point, because that's where that isolated incident now becomes the rule. It's went from being the exception and now it becomes the rule. Because, again, when we're looking at coping skills, those are taught to us by our household and by the people that we're around growing up. We learn how to deal with our anger. We learn how to deal with our sadness.
Stress.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and I think even with children, they're exposed to so much more now. And they have such an inundation from online and from their friends, and being able to talk to their friends 24 hours a day, round the clock, about all sorts of different things. You know, like when 13 Reasons Why came out, that was a catalyst again. Now we're talking about mental health. Well, what does that mean? You know, RJ said, you know, your husband said, we have to define, let children define what mental health is to them. And I think this is kind of similar, you know. Children know what they know. They know what they feel. They know when mom and dad are not treating them correctly. They know when something's wrong in the house. You know, there's research that says even toddlers know what's going on in a household. They can feel the tension. They can feel, like you said, the stress. So I think that's a good point in saying it's not to say if you learn great coping skills, this will never happen. You know, there's no one perfect solution or guarantee for anything, especially when it comes to mental health. There just isn't. But I do think when you have, we've talked about wraparound or we've talked about support, I think that can be a key factor that's missing with a lot of these families is support. And that can just be voluntary because parents don't want to disclose, well, I'm financially strapped. There's stigma with being in poverty, or I have mental health. There's stigma with that. So I think, like you said, it's not to be callous and say it's just, it's a basic, well, you don't know how to cope. That's what the problem is. I think it's obviously there are more factors than that. But I think when you're at the very beginning and you're talking about prevention, that can be where you can have the right timing to intervene, where it goes from, we can add some more coping skills, some more support before we really go down the rabbit hole. You were going to say something, Amy?
I was just going to say that I know, like, here in our county, you know, the two things we see the most are domestic violence and substance abuse in foster care cases. And substance abuse is, it's very hard, and those cases take a long time, mm-hmm. because getting through an addiction and overcoming addiction, that takes time. And I know we've talked a little bit about the court process, and you're only really as fast or as slow as your parents are kind of getting through their homework, is how we explain it to kids. Mommy and daddy have homework to do. Mm-hmm. You know, for kids to start moving on that road back to home, and substance abuse cases take the longest for permanency to be achieved because it's so, so difficult. Mm-hmm. And also just the resources as far as like inpatient versus outpatient, it is really hard to get to an inpatient bed for rehab. It's very hard.
Yeah, there's a lot of wait lists.
Yes.
They might not even get in here in Champaign County.
Correct.
They might be out of county.
Springfield.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so that plays a part in it. You know, you're removing them now from their home, which if you watch, some people I know like to watch the show Intervention. Again, there's the media's version of it. But, you know, in those stories, most of the time they say they don't want to come back to where they had their circle of users, friends. They want to go as far away as possible. That's not always going to be the case with these parents if they have children that they would have to, you know, relocate with them. So, again, it's not that simple as saying, okay, well, one of the things that's your homework is you have to get clean. That sounds so easy, but it's never easy. And like you said, not only do they have to get clean, they have to stay clean. So I think that's one of the things people don't understand when they're looking at child abuse is you're looking at the child, but what's going on around the child is so much different. They have abuse. They have all these, you know, different things that they have to work through themselves. But what do their parents have to work through? And when you have a parent who maybe gets clean, they go through addiction recovery, they're clean for a couple weeks, they get back out and they get around other people, and all of a sudden they fall right back off. Well, now that clock starts all over again. And how many times is the court willing to do that for them before all of a sudden this becomes a game? And judges, I've seen not lose their temper, but lose their patience. You know, I heard one say, this is your fourth time. How long do you want your children to wait? Not how long do you want the court to wait? How long do you want your kids to wait? And if they were standing right here, what would you tell them? As far as, oh, well, now it's going to be another 28 days at the minimum. That's just the actual addiction recovery. And so I think that's, again, where people on the outside have quick judgment. Well, you should be able to get clean. These are your kids. Why would you ever pick an addiction over your children? Those are your children. Again, it's just, it's so not that simple. And it can even be hard for domestic violence. That can be just as much of a pull, which I'm sure all of you have seen, where you have to leave this person. You have to leave your paramour. There's violence. Okay, well, now the parent's thinking, I have to choose what I want over what is best for my children. And they may not actually be able to distinguish that, as hard as it sounds. It may be hard to think that, why would you ever choose somebody who's abusive to you and could eventually be abusive to your children? Although I've heard that justified, they never touched my children, they just touched me, so it's okay. But, you know, that can be just, you know, as much of a pull.
It's as much as an ugly cycle, I do believe, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So, and then again, you know, we're talking about long-term for children who observe observe domestic violence. Do they become the perpetrator when they grow up, or do they become a victim? You know, do they get accustomed to thriving around chaos? There are some people who, as adults, they have to be in tumultuous relationships because that's all they've known and that's all they're comfortable with. And so now they're moving down the road towards domestic violence. But I think, you know, we've kind of talked about what can lead up to it, but when we're trying to be a mandated reporter, or we're trying to just, like you said, be a concerned person, what are we looking for when it comes to signs of child abuse?
Well, I think there's, you know, several kind of things that you can look for depending on the category of abuse. I think overall, you know, a child could be feeling guilty or ashamed. They might have maybe a fear of their parents or caregivers. Sometimes they're overly affectionate with people that they don't know very well. They could be withdrawing from their friends. You might notice some depression. You could see frequent absences from school, reluctance to leave school activities, maybe running away or rebellious behavior. If we're thinking about, you know, physical abuse, of course, with infants, we think about failure to thrive. That would be something a doctor's office could diagnose. Any unexplained injuries or injuries that have a pattern, either in a circle or in kind of a straight line that doesn't look like it was just an accident. Maybe there's injury to areas of the body that are usually protected, like the insides of their arms or legs or their back. Additionally, if we're thinking about, you know, sort of sexual abuse, a child having knowledge of what's inappropriate beyond what their age should be. Thinking about, you know, if a child has, you know, blood in their underwear, statements that they were sexually abused, trouble walking or sitting, complaints of genital pain, those would be things we would look at. As far as emotional abuse, we would think about, you know, maybe social withdrawal, a lack of interest or enthusiasm, sort of the, you know, physical symptoms, headaches, stomach aches with no medical cause, avoidance of certain situations, refusing to go to school, not wanting to go on the bus, maybe a decrease in school performance, or maybe they revert back to some previous behavior, you know, bedwetting, things like that, that they might not have demonstrated before. As far as neglect, we might see some different things like poor hygiene, you know, child hoarding food. We might see, you know, emotional mood swings, taking food or money because they're hungry and they don't have any food to eat. We might see poor growth, poor weight gain. Again, those are just some of the signs and symptoms that we would see, and it is specific to exactly whether it's abuse or neglect and kind of what type.
Mm-hmm. Which, you know, we know what research has said and we should be looking for, but is it ever that simple as, okay, this is maybe a subtle thing that I picked up on? Again, I think that's where that fear comes in. What if I'm wrong? So, you know, what would you tell somebody who may suspect that something's going on with the child?
If you're in doubt, make the call. Let the professional make the determination.
So, Crisis Nursery, you have Darkness to Light as your training. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So, Darkness to Light is a sort of comes from an awareness or a prevention standpoint. It's for anyone in the community who might be interested in learning more about child sexual abuse. That stems from the Jerry Sandusky case and was funded to sort of make an awareness for caregivers. So this could be for daycare providers, professionals, anyone in the community who wants to learn more about being an advocate. What this program does is provide specific sexual abuse training to recognize the signs that Stacy was talking about. Just that withdrawn nature, how to create that space for a child to share those things, how to pick up on signs, you know, sort of not to take that innocent bystander approach, but to really be the advocate for that child when you do see those signs that something could be going on. And then sort of also how to make those next steps. How do we talk about it? Who do we call? Just many of the things we've been talking about today. So it's a video application. There's a workbook, excuse me, and then a discussion that usually follows that as well.
Yeah, I've actually gone through that training, and I thought it did a great job of being comprehensive, but not in such a clinical way where you feel like you have to have a PhD to be able to apply what you just learned. I do think that for somebody who is a mandated reporter by their job, it can be hard to know how to facilitate that conversation if you suspect that a child has had any type of abuse or neglect. So again, without making them a clinical professional, if you have somebody, for instance, who's a neighbor and says, I just have this feeling that something not right is going on in that house. You know, little Susie or Bobby walks by my house every day while I'm outside. How can I check in with them to get an idea of if this is going on?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. I think, you know, bringing it down to kind of its basic level for, you know, neighbor, Joe, anybody to have that conversation versus, you know, kind of picking your time and place carefully, making sure that you're choosing a space where the child is comfortable. Ask them, you know, where would be a good place for us to talk, or maybe it's while they're playing. Avoid talking in front of someone who may be causing the harm. And 4 out of 5 times, that's a parent or relative. Also being aware of your tone, make it really light, make it casual. If it's non-threatening, that'll help put the child at ease and it'll provide you with more accurate information. I think too, you know, talk to the child directly, ask questions that use your own vocabulary, but are a little bit vague. So you could say, has someone been touching you? In this context, touching can mean different things, but it's a word the child's familiar with. So they could respond with things like, no one touches me except my mom at bath time, or you mean like the way my cousin touches me sometimes? So understand also that sexual abuse can feel good to a child. So asking if someone is hurting them may not bring out the information you're looking for. I think too, avoid judgment and blame. You know, say something like, I'm concerned because I heard you say you're not allowed to sleep in your bed by yourself, rather than you said something that made me worry. I think too, reassuring the child, let them know they're not in trouble, they didn't do anything wrong, you're just asking questions because you care about them and you just want to know how they're doing. And then be patient. This isn't just like our 13 Reasons Why show, one conversation. This might be multiple conversations that happen. And again, as the other professionals have said here, go ahead and make that phone call. As a professional, I always say it's not my job to determine whether or not the information is accurate. It's just my job to determine that there was some information that needs to be reported on. So whenever you're in doubt, go ahead and make that call. We don't have a perfect system per se, but it's the best that we have. Mm-hmm. And we really need to be utilizing it to protect children.
Mm-hmm. I was going to add that young children do a lot through play. And so a lot of times they don't even have the words to describe what's happened to them, or they can't put a name to it. But if you were to give them toys, or you were to, you know, give them a comfortable environment, but don't underestimate. If you see something concerning, like if it's your neighbor and they come over and they're playing oddly with their toys or something, those are real good signs that something's going on. They don't have the vocabulary, but they will act out through play.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've talked about, you know, there's a lot of different effects when it comes to child abuse. But when you're wanting to have this conversation to really convince somebody to be involved, when you're talking about the effects of child abuse, what would you want kind of Joe Average to know about the effects of child abuse?
Well, I think those effects are long lasting. I mean, if we think about some of the things that it can cause, we're really thinking about delays in physical and psychosocial development, resulting in, you know, neuropsychological functions. To break it down, attention, processing speed, language, memory, social skills, those are long lasting. If we think about things like reactive attachment disorder, inability to bond with caregivers, things like, you know, mental illnesses, if we think about, you know, different personality disorders, bulimia, again, can, you know, also getting that cycle of abusing, you know, someone after that. So it's almost like we really need to look at the prevention aspect of it as well.
Yeah, I think one of the things that sometimes gets discounted is that if a child is removed from their parents, they're removed from their parents. So these are people they've lived with their entire lives, good or bad. You know, it can surprise people that when a child has the right to make the decision about whether to engage with their parents, especially if their parents' rights have been terminated, they will re-engage with them, because that's your parent, that's your mom and dad, that's all you've ever known. And so I think we discount a lot of times the effects of being in the foster care system, that even if you are with fictive kin or a relative, you're still not at home with your parents. The person who you have been around every day is still not there. So I think we discount just that disruption by itself can just turn your world upside down. And so, you know, I'm sure there's all these other effects, but just even the very beginning of the process, you're now asking children to function in their everyday life at school, you know, going back to a new, well, essentially establishing a new normal because they're no longer home. I think that all by itself is something that can start to change the way that they're looking at their life and the world around them. You were going to add something, Amber?
I was. One thing, though, that I don't want to discount is how resilient children are, mm-hmm. especially when they're getting what they need. You know, children that have been through traumatic experience, but they get counseling services or they're in a positive environment, they do function so much better. They absolutely love their parents. I don't know very many kids that cut off all contact from their parents, but there are some that do. you know, but kids also are resilient when they're put in the best setting that they can be to help them grow.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's also, again, part of the system that does work is making sure that the kids that come into care have those assessments that determine what does this child need from the traumatic, you know, experience that they suffered through to mm-hmm. help them grow and move forward.
Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about ways for people to get involved, obviously here we've said if you suspect something, do something. But there are other, you know, more formal ways of doing it. So we have our Darkness to Light training, and then you can be a wonderful CASA volunteer. I've always loved CASA. I might be biased because I've been a part of the group before. But so tell us kind of basically what CASA does.
Sure. CASA, we are the GAL program for Champaign County. So we only work with children that are in the foster care system. In a GAL, that means guardian ad litem. We are appointed by the court to represent only the child. So in the court system, when you have a family that is newly involved, mom gets her own attorney, dad gets his attorney, and the child has their own attorney. And then we represent the child. So we represent what's in their best interest.
When I volunteered there and then eventually worked there for a little bit, Jack DeLamar was there, and he was always really amazing in breaking it down very simplistically about why CASA was so important. And even when he was in the courtroom, it was just amazing to watch him go to bat for those kids. And in a very subtle way, kind of checking the parents about what they were or were not doing. Something in the child welfare system, the agency gets credit for efforts. Everybody is able to get credit for efforts. And the judges, depending on who you go in front of, will let you know very clearly you are not making any effort. But I thought it was, you know, the first court session I sat in on, it was so important to see that CASA was there, because you have this one person who's just about the child. Not to say even with child welfare workers, obviously I was one of them, that we aren't there for the children, but there are so many different moving pieces in our world.
And it's a different view. Mm-hmm. They have a family holistic view, you know, and we are focusing on the child and making sure that their needs, you know, are being met.
Right.
I love CASA. I grew up in foster care in Champaign County, and CASA did not exist when I was in foster care, but I did have a GAL, and that person was Heidi Ladd for me.
Oh, wow.
So what she did for me is what we do for kids now, and that's a big reason of why I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
Kids need someone that speaks for them, that speaks their language. It's important that their feelings and what they're thinking gets said.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's very easy to just get lost in the whirlwind of the services and the visitations and all of the hoops that, you know, the parents are jumping through.
Oh, yeah.
But the kids are going through their own hoops. And it's really important that someone focuses on what their well-being is, because they need to be successful members of society. And mm-hmm. they need to function at their best selves in their life. So it's pretty great that we have an organization in town that is focusing just on the child.
Mm-hmm. So if somebody wants to be a CASA volunteer, what's the process?
Well, we do have a website, and you can go to CASA.org and CASAforKids.org and check out our website. You can come into our office. We are located in Lincoln Square. We have several trainings a year, and Brooke Adams is our program administrator, and she can walk you through the process. There is an online application that you have to fill out. You'll have to pass a background check, and then you'll have an in-person interview in our office, and Brooke will interview you. And then we'll go from there and get you set up in a training.
Awesome. And with the Darkness to Light training, how often is that offered? And what's the process for registering?
Right at the moment, we're actually in the process of training some more trainers. So that program is at a little bit of a pause for us. If you do have interest in that, however, you're welcome to email our assistant director, who is Jill Duden. She's on our website, crisisnursery.net. And we have a running list, and we're hoping within the next couple of months to get that rolling again. Once we have your email, that's something that you'll be on a listserv that will roll those times out to you when those times and dates are available.
And you do also have other volunteer opportunities for individuals who want to get involved just with Crisis Nursery in general.
Absolutely. Crisis Nursery is mostly run on volunteers. We have a small staff. But we do have several volunteers who help us. If you're interested in getting involved with volunteering, again, you can contact Jill Duden on our website to become involved with Crisis Nursery as a volunteer. You will have to pass a background check, some fingerprinting, and as well as same with CASA, an interview, things along those lines. But once we get you in the door, there's a lot of just fun caring for babies, snuggling babies, lots of great ways you can get involved. So, yeah, thank you.
So as far as just professionals in the community, are there any other programs you want to give a shout out to as far as if somebody's interested in becoming a part of the fight against, you know, child abuse prevention?
Honestly, I would have said Crisis Nursery, and she's here.
I would like to give a shout out to two different organizations that we work very closely with. One of those is the Family Advocacy Center.
Oh, yes. FACC is wonderful.
Yes. So they offer a specific program that relates directly to child abuse, since we've been discussing that today. It's the SOFT program, Saving Our Families Together Today. So this is sort of a coalition that Grace Mitchell, one of the long-running advocates for Family Advocacy Center, started. And this is basically for families who are involved with the system who might not know how to guide through or walk through the system. And so this might be just showing them how to get connected with counseling or showing them what the next step might be when they are sort of frozen within that place. And so this is a monthly 2-hour dinner and orientation, and that's something that they can find as well through Family Advocacy Center by reaching out there. Another program that I wanted to mention was Illini Christian Ministries. This is a local organization that does somewhat similar work to Crisis Nursery from a prevention aspect. This is a faith-based organization where families within our community will provide and open their homes to somewhat of a temporary foster care situation that is voluntary. So if we see maybe a family at the nursery that we think may be nearing many of those concerns that could raise our concern for child abuse, we may reach out to Illini Christian Ministries and say, hey, you know, this family could use a month to really get things together, and they can provide that support from a home aspect and from a nurturing aspect that we really can't find anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the families that we see, if they can have sort of what Amy was saying with those protective factors to buffer in the counseling, if we can have that support to come around and just help mom, a lot of times we can get over that hump.
Mm-hmm. Which I think that's great. I mean, again, it could be hard to admit that you need a break, but wouldn't it be better if you could take a break, have a chance to kind of recharge, get the right resources in place, and start over in a better space where you welcome your children home and you can say, you know, now we can start fresh, we can start in a healthier place. I think every parent has had that moment where you're just not just your children, but just everything in general is kind of mounting. And so we don't always get that breather that we need. I think some people have built-in support with family, friends, but not everybody has that. And so if you can, you know, find those partnerships in the community and be able to reach out and say, I need a break. I need to be able to find the resources to get over this hump, whatever this is that's kind of keeping me stagnant from having a healthy space for my children. It's best if you can, you know, reach out to that. Well, thank you guys for being a part of the show. This will, like I've told other guests, this will be kind of one of the first conversations we have about this type of work. All systems seem to collide together at some point, and so being able to even relate how the systems play together, I think can help to dispel, again, misconceptions, because that's a big part of what I think keeps people from getting help, is they're not quite sure how this system works or what it means as far as their part. But thank you again for being a part of the show. Again, we have four guests in the room. If you want to introduce yourselves one more time.
Amy Hayes from Champaign County CASA.
Candy Murphy, CASA Advocate.
Jessica McCann, Crisis Nursery.
And Stacey McNichol with the Rock Counseling Group.
Awesome. Again, thank you guys so much for being here. Next week, we're going to talk about different areas of the LGBT community, different things that have gone on. For instance, we had a transgender ban that was kind of handed down from the Hill. But what that means, you know, other local resources to, again, support those who may be in need of different services. And again, thank you for tuning in to In the Know on WEFT 90.1 Champaign. Tonight's show will be archived on RadioFreeAmerica.com, my personal Facebook page, Sherry Williamson, and on Tumblr at In the Know. And again, tune in next week when we will be talking to some local individuals who've actually gone through the transgender process and, again, helping to dispel what that concept's about. Thank you again.
This hour of programming is sponsored by the listeners of WEFT and Dancing Dog Eatery and Juicery.